Hello and welcome to the Park Stop Podcast. My name is Alicia Stella. With me as always, my co-host Ian.
Hey, kids.
And we're introducing a very special episode. We recorded a few weeks ago with Dave Cobb, creative director for Men in Black Alien Attack, where we talked all about the ride and got in depth in our premium podcast series.
Yeah, Dave was awesome. That was super fun.
We have lots more episodes of the premium podcast available and ready to listen on Patreon. But now here is our episode on Men in Black Alien Attack in its entirety. Enjoy.
Have fun, kids. It's awesome.
Hello and welcome to the Park Stop Premium Podcast. My name is Alicia Stella. With me as always is my co-host Ian.
Hey kids.
And today we have a very special guest to talk about Men in Black Alien Attack is the creative director for the ride, Dave Cobb.
Howdy.
I am extremely excited for this one, for this discussion. Before we even started recording, I told you I'm not going to stop gushing about this ride.
Oh, that's sweet. Sorry. Thank you.
She's already stumbling over her words.
I know, I can't. I just can't. I mean, Ian, you just saw Dave on the Discovery Channel, right?
Oh, yeah, he's like famous. The Discovery Channel. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Please. Yeah, that's like the infant version of Dave Cobb back then. I had a full head of hair, and man, yeah, I watched that video and I'm like, was that what? No, that's not 20 years ago. Come on now.
It opened April 2000. So
yep,
like
yep.
Actually yep. 20 years. That's kind of crazy. Because that Universal would let a ride stay in their park for 20 years nowadays.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. We lost a lot of our classics and I hear people saying like, I wonder if they're going to redo Men. Like you stop right there. Don't you dare finish that sentence.
You know, it's funny. I have people ask me that all the time. Like, are they gonna revamp it or turn it into something else? And I'm like, I haven't worked there in 20 years. Like, they don't call me and tell me, by the way, hey, here's what we're doing.
they don't call you up and run it by you. It's like, listen, we're gonna replace the big TV. We want your approval on the big TV. No. It's not gonna fit in the egg just right. So we want
you. No. No, my opinions mean precisely jack and squat to them. But I'm still grateful for the opportunity for having done it. You know, like you said, there's not a lot of things in theme parks in general that last that long. And
yeah,
and we certainly did not design it. I mean, you're always trying to design the best possible attraction, right? And you want something to be a perennial, but we didn't think that while we were doing it. This wasn't like we were like, all right, we need to make the thing that's going to stay in this park. It's just we just did the ride we wanted to ride. So I'm very grateful that it's lasted this long and it has the fans that it does.
But if given the chance, would you add anything or change or upgrade anything?
That's a really hard question because, like, you know, yeah, sure. There's a million things I would like to go back and do differently or fix because I, you know, you only see the flaws in working on a big project like that. You're your own worst critic. But at the same token, a big project like that is like, it's kind of like raising a kid and sending him off to college. Like at a certain point, it's not yours anymore.
Of course.
The day it opens is, and actually you can always tell and ask anybody in the industry, they'll tell you this. There's a moment around opening, usually after when you're finishing up things, doing punch list items and sort of, you know, checking boxes and making sure everything's documented right, blah, 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 all that stuff, where all of a sudden there's a security guard on site who doesn't recognize you. because he hasn't been there for the whole production. He's the new park guy. And he's like, can I see your badge? And that's the moment where you're like, all right, it's not mine anymore. But you know, the flip side of that story is the very same thing that happens is you watch people coming off the ride and enjoying it and realize, oh, it's theirs. It's not mine at all anymore. It's theirs.
That's rad.
So this replaced nothing. This was at the time in the late 90s, the mid to late 90s, I was so upset. Like it took me a decade to get over that Jurassic Park, the ride, got moved from Universal Studios Florida over to Islands of Adventure because I had to wait. It's like 1995 comes rolling around and Universal Hollywood gets their Jurassic Park, the ride first. And I'm just fuming. And I'm like, how dare you cancel my attraction? I've been waiting my whole life for this since the movie came out 2 years ago. And But now looking back, it's like, that's the greatest thing that could have happened, because we might not have gotten the Men in Black Alien Attack ride had Jurassic Park been built there.
well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's, that was absolutely intended for the site, for sure. It was the original, mm-hmm. the original concept art sort of shows it shoved in the corner, back corner, which is still actually an empty lot. It's that space between MIB and The Simpsons and back, the former Back to the Future. And so it's, it was always going to be an attraction, but yeah, IOA sort of changed those plans. And key to that, that's actually becomes key to why Men in Black happened.
Right.
Because they, about a year out from IOA opening, they realized, wait, when IOA opens, we're going to have this whole new resort with hotels and things. And the studio park, we don't have anything teed up a year later as a new attraction. And so they sort of fast-tracked this. It was a very, sort of a rushed discussion. They were so busy with not only IOA, but also USJ, that it just, the analysts, it sort of went under the radar. And then one day somebody went, wait a minute, we need to do something. And so that's how I got the job. Was the industry was so swamped at that point, because you had IOA, you had USJ, you had Hong Kong Disney,
Animal Kingdom,
DCA. So it's just, Tokyo Disney Sea. So you had think about it. There was 3 or 4 years there where it was like the new golden era of new parks being built. And so, the business was really, really, really busy. And I was working at Landmark at the time and perfectly happy as a show writer, but, was friends with Phil Hedema, who used to be the VP of creative development for the parks, for Universal Parks. And I knew him through the Gay Men's Chorus of LA. I sang with them, and it was sort of a creative and social outlet outside of work. And as I was coming out in the early 90s, it became sort of one of my key things, because it was this incredible group of 160 men of every size, shape, color, creed. It was like the best coming out ever in that group, because they're very supportive. And one of those people that was very supportive was Phil Hedema. And so I helped make shows for the chorus with him. I helped, you know, make giant foam puppets and big black light numbers. Yeah, because he, if you don't know, Phil came from one of his early jobs was with Sid and Marty Krofft, building puppets and costumes. And so the Gay Men's Chorus, in addition to singing and doing our normal big choral numbers, we were known for doing these big staged puppet numbers. And I built puppets and performed them with Phil. And so he got to know me, you know, he got to know me personally. He got to know me socially. He got to know me sort of creatively through this. And then also, while I was at Landmark, I actually pitched projects to him across the table on the Landmark side. And because, at the time, Universal used to, like, Landmark did the original concept for T2 and Spider-Man and Jurassic Park and a lot of early stuff. So they were one of the, they were sort of the Thinkwell of their day, as it were. And so he invited me out to lunch one day and explained to me this problem of, we need something like yesterday to start, that opens a year later after IOA for the studio park. And he's like, I know it sounds like this sounds like an insult. There's like nobody left in the industry, so I'm coming to you. but he's I'm like, thanks, ? No. He was very sweet about it. He was like, no, this is actually this opens up a really perfect opportunity. I've seen your work at Landmark, and I really think you're ready for this. And so he was the one to kind of invite me to make the jump from show writer to creative director, and thus begat MIB.
Thankfully.
So, yeah, when it was a popular movie, obviously, in the mid to late, what is it, 97, 96?
97, movie comes out? Summer 97 is when it came out. And that's when they went after the license, when they realized they needed attraction. It rated so high, and they wanted something for the studio park that was a movie.
Gotcha.
And so they approached in the same way they had approached other companies for, T2 and later on Harry Potter and Transformers and all that. They went to Sony and got the license for MIB.
And Sony didn't really have rides. So like this was new for the, while I'm thinking about it, did Barry Sonnenfeld, the director, have anything to do with the attraction, or did he approve anything? I know Spielberg was a creative consultant for Universal.
Yeah, no, Barry Sonnenfeld did not. I would have loved to have met Sonnenfeld. I think he's a genius, but yeah. Was not involved. Spielberg was, however, because he was one of the producers of the film. And more importantly, Spielberg was a creative consultant to the Universal Parks.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He actually executive produced the movie as well as creative. Okay, consulted for the park.
And so, yeah, they Universal Creative at the time would... and this was part of the process with Phil that he explained to me. He says, at a certain point, you're going to have to take all of the work in progress and take it down to Amblin, to Steven, and present to him. And that was like one of the thing, first things he said about the job before he offered it to me. And I was like, what?
I got to talk to who?
I got to, what the hell? Who's it? What's it now? So, so that happened, which was amazing. That happened about six or eight months in. So we had maquettes and a track plan and storyboards, and I had to pitch it to him. And you know, it. Everybody goes, "Oh my God, what was that like?" Well, it was kind of exactly what you think it's going to be like. Like you've seen him in interviews and behind the scenes, he's very personable, he's very passionate. And you know, I'm at that point a 28 year old nobody who is in a room with Steven Spielberg, and you know, we've got 30 minutes, and his assistant was like, it's a hard 30. We're out at 30. I'm like, great. I got the pitch down to like 22 minutes in the Q&A. And he enters the room. He's laser focused on you. He's very upbeat, but his attention is on you. And when you are pitching, it is all about listening. Like, he is the most attentive guy to other creative people. It was very, very gratifying. And 30 minutes turned to 45, and 45 turned to 60, and 60 turned to almost 90. He kept waving off his assistant, saying, no, change my meetings. I want to stay here. And, you know, at 28, that's ridiculously affirming that you're on the right path and that you're doing good work. And he had a million notes, and that's what Phil warned me about. He's like, take notes, because Steven will have 20 or 30 suggestions that are each going to cost you $2 or $3 million a piece. And he's like, but the drill is, we look at all of them, and Phil looks at it and narrows it down to, here's the one or two we think we can do, and present it back to Steven, and he'll be cool. But just say yes to everything. Yes. And you'd use your improv training. Yes. And everything, you know?
Yeah. A lot of people that follow the theme parks nowadays, take for granted the whole Spielberg connection. It's like, oh, he just collects his percentage every year at the door. And like, he's not really part of it. It's like, he had a hand in all of the attractions for those first 10 years or so at the Florida parks. He wanted, I used to walk around the park right after Men in Black opened and be like, Jaws, directed by Spielberg, Men in Black, executive produced, Back to the Future, executive produced, E.T., directed by Fievel, executive produced. Right. Like, this half of the park is the Spielberg half.
I'm eternally grateful for having that experience pitching to him so early in my career, because it really gave me a good lesson in just engaging with senior creatives, engaging with executives, and that not all of them are going to be jerks, and the ones, and you have to sort of lean forward and listen to the ones that are giving you the same respect. And so he was amazing. He was, but again, I sort of say, he's exactly what you think he's going to be. He's a cool guy who believes in creative people and wants to hear their voice. And so it was all systems go after that. And then if you want to know the things that he suggested that we
used, I was just going to ask some of the things that made it in and what didn't make it in that he suggested.
He originally the biggest one would be, he wanted Frank the Pug somewhere.
Oh, nice.
He's like, where's Frank? And we're like, oh, right. Well, that's, of course, like, he's a fan favorite. Why wouldn't we have him there? So he's not animated or anything, but he is there. We decided to make him more of an Easter egg. So if people don't know, he's on the right side of the right track in the locksmith shop, just like he's in the movie. And it's right after, or really during, the crashed prison ship.
Yeah.
So it's kind of behind you. So you have to sort of torque your head around to find him. But he's there, and he gets you a lot of points.
Because he's only in the first movie for a couple minutes. He becomes a more major character later on in the sequels. But at the time, he was just a little, almost like a mini cameo of a dog talking.
Yeah, he was the police informant. You know,
Agent J is like. He looks at this weird, creepy guy. He's like, oh, this guy's not even pretending not to be an alien. And then the dog starts talking.
Yeah, it's so good. And then the other thing he said was, I want to be an alien. And that's why we have the newspaper aliens
that adds
on the bench. And when it falls, they're holding a stick with a Spielberg head on it and an Amblin cap on, you know.
You know, in the movie, when it shows all the people that, like, are aliens that are being followed by the MIB, Spielberg's one of those people on the big screen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I always thought that was an Easter egg tied to it. But the fact that Spielberg demanded it, like, I want to be an alien. Like, now I know how it ended up in the movie.
Yeah, so we had to do a sculpt. There's no life casts of his face or anything. He wouldn't do one. But so we had a sculpt made, and he had to approve it. And, like, you know, and then so all of that was his idea. And then little tiny things, to be honest, a lot of little suggestions about, because we showed him maquettes and drawings of aliens that were in process. So we hadn't really built any of the aliens yet, but we showed him all of the drawings, and there were, you know, we designed hundreds upon hundreds of different aliens and narrowed it down to the ones that you see from differing levels of, some of them are just, you know, flats with glowing eyes up in windows, to fully moving characters down at ground level and everything in between. And so he had a lot of tweaks about those gags. And one of the most gratifying things he said to us when I showed him all of this stuff was, he said, "God, this really reminds me of all the little gag drawings that somebody like Mark Davis would do for the Haunted Mansion of Pirates."
Oh, nice.
And I'm like, no, you could see literal cartoon parts over my head as he said that. Like, because frankly, that's what we were going for. Like, we really looked at the park at Universal Studios, and we knew what was happening at IOA across the street in terms of attractions. And Phil and I had, and Craig Hanna and John Murdy and all the people, because John worked on this in the early days. Craig did as well. It did not start with me. It started with them, actually. Jen Sauer, who was famous for The Mummy. So the group of people at the table early on, it was going to be much more of a thrill ride. And I'll talk about that in a second. But what really came out was, MIB is about the aliens, right? It's about that fine line, as I said in the Travel Channel special, that fine line between funny and scary. And somebody in the room, I forget who, it might've been me, said, "Well, yeah, that's kind of like the Haunted Mansion." And we all went, "Hey, Universal doesn't have their own Haunted Mansion." And in a way, this was trying to be that. It was transporting you out of the real world in an elevator. That was not an intentional copy, but it was like,
serendipitous accident there.
Yeah. Cause, but we realized once we get into that world, we want it to be about this colorful collection of vignettes, right? It's a vignette ride. My favorite description of Haunted Mansion and Pirates as dark rides is that story-wise, they are a cocktail party. Right? That story-wise, they're not a linear thing. They're something you just browse through, and you pick up snippets of dialogue. And each time you go through it, you hear different people at the costume party or the cocktail party, and you notice different things. And so I love that aesthetic, and I love that they're really more operettas than they are sort of linear stories. And so we tried to have the best of both worlds. We knew we wanted a linear story. We knew we wanted a call to action and a beginning, middle, and end. But within that, we just did all these really great vignettes. And the artists that did those sketches, like, we had people like Don Carson, who I don't know if you know him, but look him up. He's amazing. He was one of the chief designers of Toontown, legendary former Disney Imagineer, works with Phil a lot now. A great animation background and layout artist named Cynthia Ignacio. She did a lot of sketches. And then we had just creature designers like crazy, like four or five of them doing different creature designs, including Neville Page, who you all know now as one of the co-hosts of Face Off, and he designed, you know, the new creatures in the new Star Trek movies. He designed the Cloverfield monster. He designed all the creatures in Avatar. He designed all the vehicles in Minority Report. He designed the Tron helmets and costumes. He, like, his first big Hollywood gig was Men in Black. Was my ride.
And, nice.
And he was a superstar talent in sort of industrial and toy design before we met him. Phil brought him in because Phil saw his work. And he was a teacher at Art Center, I believe. Was it Art Center? He's a teacher at one of the art schools, and where Phil was as well. And so he brought him aboard. And so I always joke with him now. I talk to Neville every once in a while. We have lunch a couple times a year. And I'm like, "I can't afford you anymore."
That actually brings me to my next, I was going to ask about the ride system in the ride car. Didn't he help design the look and aesthetic for the actual ride vehicle?
He did. He did the ride vehicles and the guns, and he did about half of the aliens, including the big bug.
Oh, wow.
I would say he did the more major aliens, the ones that are larger or more. I could go through and pick out the ones that he did, but the main one he did was the big bug, and because that was a tough one. Like, how do we make it look not like it's just a bunch of rock work, you know? And because yeah. We knew we couldn't afford every last piece of it moving. So Universal did tout it at the time as the world's largest animated figure, which is short of, but you know, that's marketing. No, the vehicle, he did do the vehicle and the gun designs, and that took a lot of iteration. But going back to what I said about it starting out as a thrill ride, early on there were concepts of this that I was not involved with. There were two or three Blue Sky concepts thrown around. One of them was like a coaster that had onboard guns, which was never going to work.
As you go down a hill.
Yeah, they were like hard mounted, like turrets, but
okay.
But at high speed, they realized that's never going to work. But originally, it was going to be because they knew they had a short development time. They wanted to use an existing ride vehicle, so they used that. Initially, they had earmarked, because of how excited they were about it, they earmarked the Spider-Man vehicle. And so, when I came on board, the Spider-Man vehicle was in the Blue Sky concept, and one of the first things we did was we went over to Spider-Man and set up laser tag targets and rode the regular ride with laser tag targets and tried to shoot at things. And it was freaking impossible.
Shocker.
Right. And so it's like, well, you know, it was one too many things, the added movement, you know? So we said, well, we want a little bit of a thrill. So what do we do? What ride vehicle do we use? And again, they were like, we would really love to use an existing one. And so Cat in the Hat, somebody brought it up and we went and rode it and played with the spin and how fast it could go and how many, and how we can change direction. And then we realized, oh, but that gives this the same advantage of Spider-Man and even the Omnimover in Haunted Mansion of being able to direct you and point you at things. So that really became the real reason for it. The thrill became secondary. We knew we wanted a couple of wee moments, but nothing crazy. Because at the end of the day, it was going to be about the gameplay. And so that positionable vehicle also gave us a stronger way to tell a linear narrative amongst the chaos of allowing people to look everywhere and shoot everywhere.
It took me several years to realize it was the same ride vehicle, like, because it's such a different experience. That at some point I was like, wait a minute. Like, it finally occurred to me. But yeah. The spinning has been decreased on the Cat in the Hat ride. So I'm glad that we still have the Men in Black experience to still get the full spinning. And I'm, you know, for all those people that hate that they took down the spinning on Cat in the Hat, it's like, that's so that little kids can go on it. You know, get why they did it. And besides, we have the Men in Black for the older kids. Like, it works out that way.
But you're trying not to spin on that ride so you can get the points.
Well, right, there's parts that spin regardless.
Yeah, sure. I know, but yeah,
there's a couple of hard spins. The funny thing is that actually became a point of an interesting point during playtesting. So we got the ride running, most of the stuff in. We're starting to program the rides and playtest. And what we realized was, if you were really good at the game, you had a really shitty ride. Because if you were so good that you hit everything, nothing, because the whole original idea was you can shoot them, but they can shoot back. Right. That was the big change. And we realized that can't happen with all of them. That has to happen at a couple of places. But even those few places were like the big smoke blast guy after the crash and the guys looting the pawn shop on the left. Those are the two big first spin moments for both tracks. Mm-hmm. Those were originally optional. Those were going to be a timing thing of, do you hit them, do you not? And if you hit them in time, you don't spin. And it just disappointed people because they weren't spinning. And they saw the other vehicle spin, right? And so it became this careful thing of, the only place we're really going to put the variable spin is when the vehicles are shooting at each other, which is a whole other thing we figured out later on. That tunnel was not originally that. That tunnel was originally the super speed moment from the movie. You hit the red button and went fast.
Well, wasn't one of the ideas for the ride vehicle to be the car, the don't push the red button car
Ford POS. Yeah. yes. And there was no way, you know, Neville was one to show us that on that chassis, there was no way to get that down to to design it within that, the small framework of that ride vehicle, and the proportions of it would have looked weird. It would have looked very, he did it one, I think he did one napkin sketch that I never kept of like, here's what that might look like. And it was, you know, it looked very chibi, if you know what I mean. It looked like very cute, kawaii, like, you know, Japanese design version of the Ford clunky car. It looked, you know, it didn't look like it fit in the MIB world. So that's when we said, nope, other direction entirely. This is a training vehicle. We'll make it look like alien tech and go a completely different direction.
I really like the sloshing fuel tank in the back. I don't think people notice or take that in, as that's just brilliant.
I fought for that, because liquid inside of something like that, you know, the concern is, how do you seal it? Does it evaporate? Does it get gunky over the years?
It's like a wave machine. I stare at that thing when I'm in the waiting.
it's like mineral oil or something that's been tainted. Yeah, so it doesn't go bad. Exactly. But I fought for that, because we were like, it's got to look like, you know, alien, like something weird. Anyway, so I'm glad it's still there.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so interactive system, the guns. So that's always, since you came onto the project, that was always a big thing. It was going to be an interactive ride, which there weren't that many of back then. Like nowadays, we're getting kind of used to it. It's becoming the norm almost for new attractions, some interactivity. But back then it was definitely kind of like cutting edge, so to speak.
I think there were two at that time. There was one on an early Sally one called like Turkey Shoot or something. I forget. I'll look it up. There was one from like the mid 80s. And then of course Buzz Lightyear. And so Buzz Lightyear was the only one on the map, and they had just opened the Florida version of it, which was the mounted guns.
Yeah. It's if you had wings turned into an interactive Delta Dreamflight, excuse me.
You had wings.
And that ride annoys me to no end, because I have to spin the vehicle to face where I want to face. But then also it's an omni mover, so it's also moving the ride vehicle at the same time. And it's like, stop it. I just moved to face the way I want to face. And then the mounted system, and my thumb hurts from the button, and then all the Z's. I hate the Z's. I think I heard you talking about how you didn't want to have targets to shoot at. You wanted to just, and I think if you went on the ride and didn't want to interact, it's still a really good dark ride, Men in Black Alien Attack. And I think that's why it succeeds as a ride and also succeed as an interactive ride, because it technically is a good ride on its own.
Thank you. That was a very much a goal. We were like, you know, somebody's grandma is going to get on this and not know what to do with the gun. So we need to make sure she has a good time too.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that you noticed that.
No offense to something like Millennium Falcon, you know, Smuggler's Run or something, but if you don't play along with that, you're not going to have a good time. Like, you have to keep jamming that button if you're in any of the seats, or it's not, everyone's going to yell at you.
Yeah. And I think a ride like that, in terms of interactivity, is going to blossom when they have more than one mission, right? Right now it's the same one. And so if the promise is, eventually they're going to have 8 or 10, like DLC on your PlayStation, great.
Or so, even having interchangeable sections the way that they do on Star Tours. If it just all of a sudden went to a different situation or turned right instead of left, it would blow my mind, and I would enjoy it so much more. So the interactive guns, it's essentially, because this is 20 years ago, it's essentially laser tag technology. We see a laser, but that's just for pointing, right? It's actually infrared that's doing the target, like the actual point allocations.
Yeah, it's basically a TV remote with a laser pointer attached to it.
Infrared.
Fun fact, the company that designed the gaming system, meaning the games and the targeting and the scoring, was the same company that did Buzz Lightyear. It's a company out of Dallas called Heads Up Technologies. They do high-end aeronautic technology, like plane stuff. But they had this little side business that rolled out around Texas, that they became a provider of laser tag equipment for the laser tag arenas. And so they were, you know, one of the people that showed at IAPA every year. And so because they had done ride vehicles and they had done Buzz Lightyear, we engaged them and said, all right, here's what we want to do different. And one of the biggest ones was Men in Black is about holding the weapon, not mounted to the vehicle. So we got to be able to hold on to it. So we have to keep that in mind. And the target thing was an interesting one because we had a lot of philosophical discussions about that. The thing about Buzz Lightyear that is always sort of difficult the first time you ride is because is that you get laser focused on those Z's and that's all you look at. And you really don't notice anything else until the second or third or fourth ride, which is not necessarily bad. But we were like, is there a more creative way to telegraph that where to shoot on these things? That doesn't have to be a single place. And so one of the biggest challenges of MIB is that each of those aliens is covered in sensors underneath those hard skins with little, you know, a mesh coverings mm-hmm. over these infrared sensors. And there's dozens of them on some characters. And that's why we train you in the queue. We're like head to chest, basically. Don't worry about running out of ammo. That's why we say in the queue, you won't run out of ammo. Keep shooting. Here's mm-hmm. where they're most vulnerable. And we hoped that that would come across for people and they would
especially,
get that, you know.
It takes three or four hits to knock some of them out. And then like the big guy with the smoke gun, like he falls over if you hit him like six times. So you got to keep shooting.
Yeah. But that became a long-term issue in terms of maintenance because all those little mesh screens have to be blown out of dust or else the game becomes unplayable. Like all of those characters need a lot of care and attention because the targets themselves are physical and if we were to make that ride today, that wouldn't be a mm-hmm. problem because the way that these rides work today is camera tracking. So in addition to the gun that you're shooting, you have these cameras looking at the set and you can literally on a screen draw, here's where a target is and here's how much it's worth. And it just becomes a camera sensing system. And so if they were to upgrade the ride, that'd be the first thing that they should do.
I'm sure Marvel's new Spider-Man ride where you web sling, I'm sure something like mm-hmm. that is using more just all camera technology, sensing where your hand is and then extrapolating where you're going to hit and then giving you points without any need of sensors whatsoever, just tons of, you know, mapped cameras everywhere. I went to Legoland Florida and they have there's like an adventure ride where you use guns to shoot and they have the same type of infrared sensors, but they don't have the meshes over them. So you could see these like big black dots on all the characters in multiple spaces. and it really makes you appreciate how much work and effort went into the theming of Men in Black Alien Attack to keep the aliens, you know, completely covered and fleshed and knowing that they have to go blow out like the dust out of the little mesh holes. Like that kind of blows my mind, but that's the technology at the time and you did the best, you know, with it. Well, and I'm glad.
Well, we did talk for a while that the option would, we said, if we do have to put a target on, what can it be in world? Can it be in the story? The Z's in Buzz Lightyear are lightly that, but not really, right? Like what could it be in the MIB world? And because they were all prison transport escapees, we thought, what if they had like a prison collar on?
Yeah.
Like a big metal thing with an obvious big red light on it, then or big green light on it. Then when you shoot, it turns red, like it locks them back up. And that was discussed for a while, but then because a lot of the aliens have been designed already, it was like, well, where do we put it on them? And that's this added layer.
This one doesn't have a head.
Right. He doesn't, he has an arm. Like he's just one big eyeball.
Just like, a tentacle in a window. Where does it go on that one?
Yeah. So that idea fell by the wayside for that reason. It just didn't become practical. So we sort of said, all right, let's stick to our guns and stay this course. And to be honest, it's one of those things I look back on and go, I think we did okay. And, you know, as you're telling me, people love the challenge of the shooting. I still think for beginning players, I would have loved to find a better clue. And I think with modern technology, we probably could have done something either with video projection on top of them mm-hmm. or something like that's another little fun fact. One of the things we found in playtesting that people wanted was feedback when they missed something.
Yeah,
and we do that with audio. There's a shooting sound and then a shoot with a hit, right? People wanted to see something, and that's kind of impossible. But we did do and this is 98 technology in terms of cameras and video projection, which for you kids in the room, that's very expensive and very small. And we did a mock-up on a section of scenery that we called, what did we call it? The Missed Hit Initiative. And it was this quick and dirty mock-up where we had a camera looking at one of the sets, and we had a video projector on the same set, and went where it saw a an infrared dot from one of the guns that was not a target. It would animate a pre-animated little sprite of like a little splat.
Yeah. With like Rise of the Resistance has for all the missed shots coming from the stormtroopers.
Exactly. So we were thinking about that kind of projection mapping way back in 98. But then you apply that to the entire square footage of the ride. Mm-hmm. And it was like $20 or $30 million to cover the ride. So it was like, at the time, video was that kind of video to cover that much space in video was really hard and expensive. So it went away, but we were thinking about that way back then. And now you see it in attractions all the time.
Does the back of the gun have a red and a green light? Was that?
Yes. Yeah. That became miss and hit. So when you fire and it would just be red if you fire, and cause it is a infrared is a two way beam. When you basically all of the characters in the ride are sending out a signal saying I'm here, right? When your infrared engages with that character, it immediately sends back to the gun at light speed, you got me. And so the triggering of the character of that you got that score is not through some wiring up through underground and up through the ride vehicle. It's literally in the air through the infrared beam. And so and that's how we have a game system on board the vehicles knows whether to use the red or the green on the back.
Right. So you have something there for people to know that they missed. No one notices it, but it is there technically.
Yeah.
Aim far, kids. Aim far. I learned that from the special.
I always aim for the windows, and I get most of my score from these two or three windows in the right after the jailbreak scene. But they added, and I don't know if they were always there, but they added curtains that open and close on, yeah. And they'll stay closed at a certain point until your cars get out of the scene for the next one to go. I got 999999. A few years after the ride opened, and I have not been able to get it again since those curtains went up there.
Have you seen there's a club on Facebook? There's a Facebook group called what is it? I'm looking for right now while we're talking. It's called the MIB 900 Club.
Nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they've got like almost 2,000 members, and they're all like pass holders. This one of the guys that runs this guy named Nick, and he reached out to me. And you know, said, hey, we have this club. We're big fans. We hope you can join us. So I do. And it sort of lets me keep tabs on all the fans. But what's amazing is like all of them can max out. Like I can't max out. I couldn't max out 20 years ago. We thought we had set it to something that was pretty impossible to do.
I had to ride 10 times in a row. I worked there. I worked at Jaws, and I was actually cross-trained there. So one day after work, I asked the fellow team members, like, can I just keep going? And they're like, well, you have to get off. So just come back around through baby swap. And I was like, okay, no problem. And 10 times it took me, and I finally got straight nines. And then they put curtains a year later.
Womp, womp.
I do like how the lighting effects, like the starburst lighting on the windows to give you like, and there's a sound effect of a window breaking, like to yeah. You know, you actually, cause those are flats in the window, but to create some kind of effect, like, yeah, you got me. Like there's a big flash, gobo light type thing and the sound effect and, other ones, aliens will fall over and stuff like that. So I love that there's actually reactions. It's like the old shooting gallery in Adventureland or Frontierland. Like it's something that's interacting. So, you know, you hit something.
Yeah. And that, you know, how we addressed all the targets in terms of that was, you know, think of it like a menu, like A to E, like A would just be a lighting change. B would be, you know, a lighting change with a one axis animated thing like the curtains. You know, C would be a character that has one or two axes of motion. D would be four or five axes of motion. And E would be a complicated AA that has multiple moves like the guy in the last scene. Oh, the guy in the last scene, by the way, with the hot dog cart, right? That's going, ow, hey. What are you shooting at me for?
The ricochet sounds just over and over again. Sounds,
yeah. First of all, that's my voice.
nice.
That's awesome.
So same with the, I'm also the voice of the tailor at the end. It'll be ready next Wednesday.
That's all I ever hear now. No, you know, because I'm the best.
and I'm the voice of the, not the talking worm, but the one going, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The one listening in the break area?
In the break room, yeah. The guy that did the voice of the worm, also did the voice of the coach alien in the middle ending, And he is also the voice of Spider-Man across the way at ILA.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, you know, that alien, he seems so big and he's got such great movement. It seems weirdly out of place in that scene. Like, where does he come from and why is he so important? Part of it was we wanted to keep your eyes off of looking over at the big bug about to turn the corner.
Right, right.
But if you look at his spacesuit, look at it very carefully next time you ride, because you'll notice it has the same design cues as the crashed spaceship in the first scene. He was originally that weird orange guy that pops up out of the wreckage at the front of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
That was originally the guy in the suit.
Whoa.
He was originally up there. And as we were placing characters, we realized, oh my God, this is a scene where we're opening up the world and it's the first big reveal of the street and people are going to be looking everywhere. Then we're putting this big complicated character where nobody can see him. And on top of that, because it was an attraction that went from nothing on paper to opening day in, you know, 24 months, 23 months, it didn't fit. We had gotten to that point where it was like somebody made a measuring error and it was like, oh great, we got this big expensive fit here.
Doesn't the ET screaming sound play when that first one pops up? When it's like
it's a scream. It was not taken from ET on purpose, but it's from some sound library, so it may well be, but it's not that it wasn't done.
As soon as you said it, it like popped into my head, and I'm like, that sounds like ET. So now we have like that. It's kind of like an empty space. You put something very like complicated to look at to distract us from turning our head because there's no aliens over there. That's except for the two eyeballs in the wall above him. There's not much to look at. So that's brilliant, actually.
I wish everybody could hear each of the individual alien voices and noises, that their attract mode and their hit, because they're all different and they're all weird and funny. The hot dog ones are my favorite. They're actually like they're like chittering like little teeny little baby aliens on the way up, and then when you hit them, they all in harmony, like a three part harmony, go hot dog. So here's another little tidbit. The voices of the aliens are all over the map. They're everybody. They're me and the sound guy and library sounds. There's not like you know, there's not one person that did all of them, but one of the people we did bring in to just record, lay down something for all the aliens and we would use and modify is Michael Winslow, the guy from Police Academy. Yeah. Yeah. He was a friend of somebody at Sound Deluxe, who were the company that did the sound engineering and design for the ride. And evidently if he doesn't live in Florida, he goes there a lot for some reason. And so we had him in, and I would literally just from the booth, I would bring up on screen, what does this guy sound like? And put up an alien, and he would riff. And so I spent like an hour or two with Michael Winslow making weird, funny noises for our aliens. So he's in there. I can't really tell you which, cause I don't really remember, but it was a lot. He made a lot of noises and we kludged him together with lots of other noises to make everything that you hear in there. But it's cacophony, you know. I wish crazy. People could hear individual things, because we tried to mix it as best we could so that some of each alien cuts through the chaos. But you know, it's kind of impossible in a ride that scale.
Well, you have the like. There's each sequence has its own like main character, almost alien. You know, whether it be the guy with the big gun, the butt alien. What's up with butt alien? he became like a main character for the attraction.
Oh yeah. What's not funny about shooting somebody in the butt? Come on now.
Or it looks like a head. And then you realize, no, that's his butt. No, wait, his butt.
That's exactly right. It's exactly right. That's the whole point. And that, you know, that's because me and Craig Hanna are 12-year-olds. So we thought it'd be funny.
That's the way to be.
You mentioned that the scanning portion where the other car is filled with bugs, what was that? Oh yeah, you mentioned it was going to be a speed tunnel, like a screen, like the Disney does often, or it actually did with the Buzz Lightyear, because it was the old Delta Dreamflight thing, like that type of thing where you're going through a speed tunnel.
Yeah, it was going to be like that, and then we realized in Buzz Lightyear they get away with it because it's a kid's ride and it's cartoony and it's not supposed to be real. And we looked at the viewing angle of that hallway that we were going to be pulling through. First of all, the track side by side is difficult because of the size of the reach envelope and the size of the motion envelope of both vehicles next to each other, just made literally the whole building a giant runway, right? We tried really hard to create moments that feel intimate, but in reality, the size of that ride track is huge. And so when we got into that, that's about the closest we got it as close as we could. And you could see out both ends of the tunnel, even if the vehicles were turned sideways, because we didn't have viewing protection like you do on like the Spider-Man mm-hmm. vehicle where you've got, blocks on the side. Spider-Man is very, like an Omnimover, is very specific about what you're allowed to look at. We didn't have that. And so the original idea was we were going to pivot you sideways to look at the wall and have fans on you. And then much like the flu powder effect that ended mm-hmm. up in Harry Potter and the Forbidden Journey, it was going to be a projection that followed you, like you were zooming down the tunnel. But, we all sort of talked ourselves into it during concept. And then as we started planning, we're like, that's going to be cheesy.
But you added another interactivity that, shooting at the other car is such a fun thing.
Exactly right. And so that's the thing. With that, we went, well, what can it be? And then we went back to, as we were game playing, we're like, well, this is a big stop in the gameplay. The biggest problem is we were hoping people would stop playing the game in this spot. But, they're not. Once they're shooting, they're going to shoot at whatever moves. And then again, it was one of those things where it's the proof of how collaborative these things are. Somebody in the room went, well, what if we shoot at each other? And we were like, what? Yes. Like, so we went to the game guys and we went to the ride guys. Is this possible? And so we went to Neville, who had already designed the vehicle. And we're like, can you add a little thing on the back? And so he came up with ideas for the little stick. And I just named it the most Star Trek-y, stupid non-tech name I could think of, which is Fusion Exhaust Port.
And, perfect. Perfect.
Sounds like it comes out of Wesley Crusher's voice, right, on the deck of the Enterprise. Sir, the Fusion exhaust port has remodulated. And then we realized how powerful a moment that is, because it literally is this palate cleanser moment mm-hmm. in the game. And it's the perfect, if you look at it from it's just one of those things where we did not plan it to be this, but I look back on it now from a pacing standpoint. If you look at cinematic structure, it is a classic end of the second act or beginning of the third. Oh,
yeah, no. And not only that, it disables your gun. So it gives you a breath, which nowadays only just now are rides really starting to realize we need that moment, whether it be like Flight of Passage in the cave, like before we get to that third act, before we get to the climax, we need a little breather to catch our breath.
Right.
And then we're going to go into it with guns blazing. I love how this ended up being that.
And the beginning of the third act is a completely different dynamic of, oh crap, now I'm on my own. Like the stakes are raised because of the other car, like shooting at each other becomes this fun, unpredictable thing, in that little construction site scene. So yeah, it was not a happy accident, but it was proof of how these things are not all designed on paper in the first phase, that as they develop, they really develop and you realize, oh, that's not going to work. That's going to change. It's more like theater than it is movie making. Mm-hmm. You're sort of adapting things as you go. And that was one of the bigger successes of the ride, was that scene.
Online, there are arguments about whether or not shooting your own exhaust port is cheating or not, but I don't even shoot at any. I know you're for it. I'm not even going to ask you about it, because I know you're for it. I saw you answer that on the live stream back in April, but I turn around and shoot the eyes on the movie posters because I don't even want to participate anymore in your shooting shenanigans. I am just going to get some points on these eyeballs.
I like that. That's nice. That's like the pacifist angle. I agree with that. That's good.
I'm going to block you from shooting those things.
So wait, does it take two hits to get it to spin? Or
no,
do you
just
not?
One.
Okay, because like the other day, it took two hits, and I was like, I saw the little exhaust port do its little animation with the LED lights, and it didn't spin the first time, and I got angry.
that might simply be ride logic, that the ride motors weren't ready to make the turn because they were in the middle of another move or something. Who knows? But the intent was one. Yeah, the intent was one.
Oh, okay, that I like that you have a logical explanation for that.
Just shoot your posters. Stop complaining.
I want to talk a little bit about the story. I love my posters. Mm-hmm. I love all the eyeballs. The eyeglass ad. There's an eyeglass ad. Those eyeballs. Yeah, there's eyeballs in the little parking meter. If it's an eyeball, I'm shooting it. The story. The universe and you relocated from the World Expo. Is it 1964 World Expo? I know it's technically supposed to be the World's Fair, but it's Universal, so we're going to pretend it's the World Expo. I like that they changed it just slightly.
Well, that's because part of the park was called World Expo.
Well, remember
Back to the Future and the International Food Court were supposed to be a movie backlot version of a World's Fair pavilion.
Right.
Like that's a weird, you know, they backed into
stretch.
That theme.
It's a stretch. Sure.
It's a stretch. Yeah. But we were like, well, now we have a chance to actually really solidify that. So let's do it.
By the way, the International Food and Film Festival was my jam. And I liked the terrible Chinese food and pizza that it served. And I was actually sad when Fast Food Boulevard took over, unlike everyone else.
I heard a bad pizza loving man.
Yeah. Well, I still have my comic strip cafe, so it's all good.
Oh.
Same food. Just as awful, just
killing
as delicious.
Killing me.
No, but I heard that originally, or one of the ideas, I think Wikipedia says originally planned, it was going to be the Orlando International Airport as the design for the ride idea.
We knew being Men in Black, it had to have a bookend, right? There's no way it can be Men in Black in the real world. That just does not jive, right? We started designing the architecture from the outside to be very sort of googie and 1950s, 60s. Originally, though, one of the concepts that was thrown out was to literally make it the Battery Vent and Tunnel Building from the movie, right? The big square box with the hallway with the fans in it, right? That was well into concept, well, almost into schematic as we started to break ground. That was going to be the entry. But we realized that building is so brutalist and industrial, and it works when you see it in the milieu of New York. But New York is, you know, six blocks away from us in the park, right?
It's right. I was going to say, if that was in New York, you know, that would be one thing. If we put standing in the middle of nowhere,
If we had put the ride in New York, the New York street section, it would have been great. So we started to talk about what else it could be, and for a while, we wanted it to be a non sequitur that you got into Men in Black training through some secret door of whatever this building was going to be. But then at the end, it's like, oh, welcome to Orlando. Like that was one of the early concepts. And it was like there would be a luggage carousel, and it would have not only human luggage, but also like weirdly alien looking luggage. there was a version that was because at the time Universal was owned by Seagram's, the ending was, and that concludes your tour of the Tropicana Orange Factory. and you would get off the ride and it'd be like, you know, signs that say free orange juice samples this way. And like you would somehow teleport it into that. And there was one where in that whole exercise where it was like, we came back and it was a sort of a Small World finale, but like Cultures of the World, which would lead us back into the International Food Court and the World Expo, site theming. Mm-hmm. But none of that really landed. It really didn't. And we realized the reason none of them worked is because they were so left field. It had to, whenever we design these things, yes, big fans of the movie are going to understand what a neuralizer does, but my grandma might not. So you have to appeal to you have to appeal to what we call waiters, swimmers, and divers, right? It's the engagement pyramid. 90% of your audience are waiters. They're going to dip their toe in. They're not going to know everything about what you're saying to them. And the middle of the audience is, you know, fans that have seen the movie once or twice that will swim around in your world and enjoy it. And then you have the divers like you who go and find every, you know, detail and know every detail. And there's even a layer below that we call them mer people because they've been super too young. And
we prefer to be called the 900 Club. Thank you very much.
They've grown gills. Whatever you do, something is going to piss them off, but they're also your biggest supporters. So, you know, anyway, it's because of that, we realized it really needed to be a true bookend. We needed a setup and a punchline. And so that's when, and that's again how these things happen. It was in this conversation about the building, because we knew what the base building was going to be, but the front was still under concept. Mm-hmm. And the architect was the one who threw out, well, what about like a big World's Fair pavilion? And then I went, well, wait a minute. This has been staring us in the face the entire time. The World's Fair is in the movie.
Yeah, like, it's right there at the end.
It's right there. And so the towers became the towers. And I'm not talking well into production. I'm talking with, you know, the concept phase is probably the first 3 months. So during that is when all of these ideas are going fast and furious. And then that came up and we're like, oh, yeah, let's do that. And so that became an exercise of, well, what is it? Does it tie directly to those towers, or are those a wink at the movie? And so we said, well, let's make it our own World Expo pavilion. And that, you know, that led to the Universe in You, that led to, oh my God, it'd be funny to start out and think you're going to that, and you get hijacked and taken down to MIB headquarters. And then the end. And so the theme literally became the setup and punchline for non-fans is the ride asks you the question, does life exist outside our galaxy? Does life exist in outer space? At the end of the ride, the answer is nope. Have a good life. So it's even though you've just seen a bunch of them, so it drives the joke home for people.
Are we alone? Of course we are.
Of course we are. Yeah.
You know, it's hilarious because that you just reminded me of the original Carousel of Progress. Like they were trying for the 1964 World's Fair, they were trying to like end on this optimistic note about the future. And General Electric, who was the sponsor, was like, no, now is the best time. And they had to redo the song. And instead of it being a great big beautiful tomorrow, it's like, now is the time. Now is the best time. And
yeah.
It's exactly the same thing. Is there life outside? Nope.
Nope, sorry. And you know, the person who wrote the song and all the music was a really talented composer named Andy Garfield, who's a dear friend of mine. And he studied at USC, the School of Composition, under Buddy Baker, who was the guy who arranged Miracles Through Molecules and The Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow and all of that stuff for Disney, right?
Yeah, Buddy Baker's awesome.
We wrote that song, and me and Tim Bernardi, who was the document controller, who was a real jokester, he and I wrote the lyrics. And then I sort of hummed it through the phone to Andy back in LA, and I said, here's what I want. And he did a quick little demo with his samples and his synthesizers. And it's by and large what you hear. Like, it was pretty perfect. And I sent it around for approval. Everybody loved it. And everybody really got a good laugh out of everybody because it was, you know, meant to be funny. And then Andy says, okay, once I get like the rough draft of this and put in, because he brought in an actual four piece orchestra to get some real instrument sounds and some singers that were friends of his, blah, blah, blah. He puts it all together. He plays me the sort of first draft unmixed version, and it's f-ing fantastic. Pardon my friends. This is a family podcast.
We'll fix it in post.
He plays it for me. He plays it for me, and I'm blown away. It's amazing. He says, I'm going to play it for Buddy. Like, wait, what? He's like, yeah, I have an appointment to go see him over on campus. I haven't talked to him in a while. He said, come on over, and I want to play it for him while I'm there.
Whoa.
And I'm like, I'm literally waiting by the phone for like the next 2 days. And Andy calls me and he says, Buddy stood up and applauded.
Oh my God. That's awesome. Seal of approval.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I very proudly went to Phil, had him over that. I went, by the way, Buddy Baker approves of our theme song. And he was like, what?
It's so perfect. That first scene, it's setting the mood secretly. Like, it has the underlying in between the verses, which are hilarious if you listen to the words, but there's this like building music in the background that's also like the MIB alien attack theme. That like is like doom, 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 doom. Like it's almost like Men in Black the movie, but it's its own version for the ride. You'll hear it like at the load station and stuff. That little nugget there always like it excites me. It gives me chills when I'm waiting in the first scene before the elevator even, and I'm like, it sets the mood so perfectly because hidden underneath the layer of the fake theme park thing is the actual story just waiting to burst out, and I love that little touch.
I also love the interruption of it. I love Zed Rip was so funny, and he was sorry about all this phony theme park nonsense, but it's one of my favorite lines in the whole ride.
And I love when the greeters really put them, or the characters, the team members that do that part, they really put themselves into it, because they'll be like, they'll act like, when they hear it turned down and then Zed start talking, they'll act like, oh, these are going to be new recruits. They'll go back, put the sunglasses on, and come back out with a gun and be like, congratulations, you've been hand selected. Like, they're really into it.
I know. It makes me, I cannot tell you how ridiculously happy that makes me, that they lean into it. I didn't work attractions like rides, but I was a tour guide at Universal Hollywood back in the day in the 80s. And so I understand the camaraderie of working in a theme park. I understand how everybody sort of leans into, you know, the thing they're doing and creates their own little family of people. I can't take credit for like fostering any of that with them. They literally just started doing it themselves. Jason Depew, who was an operator there at the beginning, is now an attraction writer, and who I worked with actually. He worked on the Warner Park with me in Abu Dhabi. But he told me all about it those early years. He's like, oh yeah, we literally treat it like you're in the MIB. And so when that comes out to the guest side of things, it makes me so happy, because it's very much like when, you know, your butler or maid at the Haunted Mansion acts all dour and goth. Like it's the same instinct. And I'm so grateful that happened. It really adds a lot.
When I got the opportunity to work there, one of the gags I came up with was, I would, you know, usher everyone into the elevator. And then I'd say, as soon as it shut, I'd be like, I'll meet you down there. And then I would go around and be at the exit door of the elevator, holding the gun or whatever they allowed me to hold. And then the doors would open, and I'd be like so out of breath. And I'd be like, I took the stairs. You guys, good luck in your training. And that's it. That would be my gag.
Oh my God, I want to hug you. That's amazing. That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
Because there'd be just enough time to do that and then run back to the other side and start the next show. I've always wanted to tell you that. So anyway,
I'm giving you the little hand heart thing.
That
makes me very happy.
I think I was trained there 2000 or 2000 or 2001, like a year after it opened. I did get to take my test on the immigration floor, like in a way to make it look like there was some activity. I remember on the big screen, every once in a while, it would loop around to like, end of the world in 3, 2, and then crisis averted. I would look up casually while doing my test and act like I'm almost, concerned. And then when it goes crisis averted, I would look back down and do my test. Like,
fantastic. That's great.
Almost concerned.
That's so good.
That's great.
I heard rumors that there was supposed to be animatronics down there in that immigration scene, besides the twins, of course.
Originally, there was more stuff behind the frosted glass. We were going to have shadow projection, video projectors with shadows of people working and aliens doing funny gags, not unlike what's in the new Star Tours queue, like that little see droids and passengers and stuff walking by. It was going to be similar to that. And again, it's one of those things that just gets cut for budget, and it didn't quite fit into the space in terms of the hardware at the time. Video at that time, large scale video projection was still pretty expensive. And the other one was going to be, because you see it in the movie, there's aliens that are walking upside down on the underside of the catwalks. CG aliens, obviously, but we wanted to have one who had like a clipboard in hand and was like looking at something and moving around. But we wanted it to be underneath the entry side. So you didn't see it when you came in. You only saw it as you got to the other side of the room. You look back and go, oh, there's a dude walking underneath. it was really just that. It was going to be some more shadow play and maybe one or two small things. We had talked about that at the time of, could we do a tiny little autonomous bot that lives, a little alien that scurries across the floor and has a couple of hidey holes that he goes into to charge up. And again, that's something you can do now that was horrifically expensive in 1998. So we threw around a lot of ideas like that. But at the end of the day, it became, hey, this is a moment where we want people to focus on that screen the most. And Bob are the best, are the ones that tie you to the movie and remind you what room you're in and why, the call to action. So,
speaking of the cuts, I was wondering, is there something that really hurt you to cut that you really didn't want to get rid of, that you had to let go? Like one thing that really hurt.
Yeah, there is. And it was cut for budget / space. And again, it's one of those things where we got to a point where there was more limited space for something than the, and it was another moving cloth. You notice on the Big Bug at the end of the ride, his right claw goes up and down. Well, we had one on the left side too. And the left side one went right over the ride vehicle. Like it's what we call in the business, it's overhead safety. Like the little teeny head that moves is overhead safety. Something that is engineered to be over ride vehicles and over guests' heads has a lot more scrutiny in its engineering than anything else in a ride because it is a potential safety hazard, right?
Yeah.
And so overhead safety things cost a lot more money. And so that limited space on the right-hand side, if you look at the ride now, it's like a wall and almost immediately it's the ride track. So there's very little space. So it would have had to have been re-engineered to be supported from above, like from the catwalk or something. And we had to cut it. And we were all sitting around the model. We had a giant model where the track was cut out and the whole model was raised up to shoulder level. So you can literally stand in and your head would be where a ride vehicle was. And it's how we evaluated sight lines. It's how you did things before. Nowadays you do it all in VR or a cave or just a CG model and look at viewing angles that way.
So you had a tangible previs that you could put your head
in. Yeah. And that's the way, I mean, that's how Disney did that for Pirates and most of their dark rides over the decades. So we did the same. And so we had Neville's giant sculpt of the Big Bug, which is gorgeous. And that one side was this thing we were talking about. And finally, I relented and said, all right, we're cutting it. And I grabbed it out of the model and walked away. And they said, where are you going? And I'm like, I'm keeping this. and so that claw sits on my bookshelf to this day as my trophy for the thing that got cut out of the ride.
Hey, you got your claw anyway.
You physically cut it right out and kept it.
And I said, this is mine now.
Going back to the queue, across from or right next to the break area with the worm guys, there's door gags that barely anyone knows about. Who came up with the door gags? And thank you.
that was me. That was me. And that was just like, you know, we talked about how a queue is both time wasting and story, but also we wanted to introduce a little bit of agency. You know, everybody loves the Indiana Jones queue with the don't pull the bamboo pole and don't tug on the rope. And that originally had, you know, five or six more of those moments that didn't make it, like don't step on the diamond-shaped stones. And there was more of that in concept that got cut for various reasons. But we said, you know, we really need some of that. And so we tried to add that wherever we could. And that hallway became a real candidate for it. The queue doesn't often back up that far, which is one of the things I probably would change. I probably would have put them later on. I probably would have put them in the weapons room or something. But yeah, that was just an attempt to like, let's give guests something to poke at to make the world more real. And
anyone listening, if you're walking through the serpentine hallway after the elevator, on the right side are some doors. One says fingerprint removal. If you jiggle the handle, it'll zap you. It goes bzzz. The other one's what? Airlock? And it like blows air
something
out?
Oxygen. It's like oxygen-free zone or something.
And that's it.
And you do it and you hear a sucking alien noise and you get blasted with air.
It's good stuff.
Universal's really good at the terrifying blasts of air. You know?
And there's also a corkboard there with hilarious things that are like lived in to create the universe like a more believable place. So just sit there and read everything and try the door. There's like a reset time on those door handles too, like a good minute or so, so that no one else can keep doing it.
Right. And those and that bulletin board with all of the stuff on it is various team members. Like I said to everybody on the team, like make me a funny for sale thing or help wanted or something like that's something you would put up in the employee break room here. And so that was everybody submitted ideas. And then me and Tim Bernardi, again, the document control guy who was a real clown, ended up writing all of them. So it was a lot of fun.
Random question. It just occurred to me with all the pre-show, the queue videos and stuff. There's one where the two different types of guns, the zappers are being explained and it's like, oh, it's Noisy Cricket version 2. And then the other one's the Series 4 Alienator. Why does Zed call it Jumbo Judy?
That's just
why? And I think think Jay actually says, oh, it's a long story. You don't want to hear it. Like, what? What's the story?
That was just one of the comedy punch up moments. Like after we wrote the plot of I wrote the first draft of that, we were like, let's punch this up. And I had a friend of mine, Sean Abley, who was a comedy writer in LA. He ended up sort of punching up, and that was one of his gags. And I loved it. And it always made everybody laugh in the room when we read it. So it was just ridiculous. And you know, you get the feeling that Zed as a character is a bit of a potty mouth and a ruffian in a way. And so I thought it was perfect for him. And he, again, even he chuckled when we did this table read with him. He was like, he got a laugh out of him, which made me happy. But you know, a lot of the stuff that Will did, we scripted it, but we also, when we sent him the script, we're like, you know, you tell us how you want to change this. Cause he said, you know, I'm going to bring one of my writers along. Is that okay? We're like, yeah, sure.
Oh, nice.
Cause that's your stock and trade in movies is, you know, you bring this level of comedy. So everything from the moment, the stuff he says in the pre-show to the stuff he's the versions of the endings of the different scores, mm-hmm. that's all him. Like I told him we had X number of versions. I forget what the number is. Of high, middle, low, and the various iterations, both low, both middle, both high, high and low, high and middle, middle and middle. You know what I mean? Like I gave him, here's the number we need. And here's the idea behind each one. You're telling one vehicle they did great and the other they did awful, or one, or both that you did, or both that you did terrible, or both.
I would
that
describe
you, did just okay.
You all as woo and you all as woo.
And you all as woo.
Woo. Yeah. Woo. Woo. Woo.
Yeah. Yeah. That's entirely him. Like we wrote none of that. We got pure Will Smith for that. And my favorite one, he's like, you all over here, we're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you all over here are like, ah, they shooting. You know?
I don't think I've ever gotten that one.
Oh, it's really funny. They're all pretty great.
And that's my next question. Multiple endings. And you know, not just multiple endings. No one ever talks about it. There's actually multiple like voiceover phrases throughout the ride too, or at least 2 points of the ride that I could think of. Maybe three. Like that's something that was new. I don't think Buzz Lightyear has something like that. Like Buzz Lightyear has the three different score levels. Like you have the Galaxy Defender, Cosmically Average, and Bug Bait, but it doesn't have something like so many different combinations. The two, you know, left, right side animatronic endings, and then the, you know, Will Smith talking, even at the very end, depending on what three levels you get, Will Smith, when he neuralizes, you said something different, you know, like that's pretty hot. Too bad you're not going to remember any of it. That's the only one I ever see. So, like that was, is it just two times during now I want to ask during the ride. Now that's what I'm talking about. MIB material. Like that's after the alleyway scene. And the other one is, right after the real training session. Is there any more that changed throughout the attraction, or is that the only two?
I think it's those two, and then the finale moments. I don't remember offhand, to be honest, but we did realize that there were moments where, like, we can, the onboard vehicle system knows the score of everybody at any given moment. So we tried to find moments that were dramatically appropriate, like a big showdown with one of the bigger characters. The calm down moment after that could be either encouragement or chiding you for not doing well enough. And so that was just we knew we had that the audio cueing could be tied to the score. And that was an easy thing to do because of the game system. So that was that, that's why that decision happened. And then at the ending, it just makes sense that it was one of the big things we wanted to do different than Buzz Lightyear. It was multiple endings. And so how that came about with those three different, basically the blank hallway, that was just a lot of spitballing of how to make a ending visually different three different ways, but in the same space. And so we did it as simply as possible and used the vehicle pivot as the way to tell that story. So it's the simplest gag ever. It's just two scrims, really. The hardest one to figure out was what to say when you've got, you know, Bug Bait, and it was just an empty hallway.
Okay. I was going to ask, what's the third thing? So there's actually a lower level than seeing the boss.
I think I don't recall the old level was, yes, you only faced forward and it was the sound of crickets and
that is perfect.
And Will's voice, like, well, I guess you got to try again or something. I forget what it was. And we played around with it. If now that you jog my memory, I think what happened was we realized that it was a real letdown.
Yeah.
So that yes, there are three scores levels, there are three rankings, and there used to be three different endings, and Bugbait was an empty hallway. And, okay. and if you notice the way that hallway's lit, it's lit with like downlights on the wall. Mm-hmm. Well, those patterns of the downlights are painted on the scrim as well to look like, you know, a hallway Whoa. Of lights, right? And so the idea was to just show that facing forward, but it was way too subtle, and the room is so plain because it's just these black walls and the score ranking names in front of you that it didn't really play. So we ended up saying, all right, everybody below a certain level gets the coach.
Okay. Basically, you zigged when you should have zagged.
Yeah.
I vote for the crickets. I think that's funny.
Yeah. Well, like, if you had never done the ride before, though, you wouldn't know that there's other alternative right. options. So that would be your first again, experience.
Right. And that goes back to, it's got to work for everybody. It's got to work for. And so at the end of the day, what do I want? Do I want to tell people they failed, or do I want to encourage them to go again? So that's why we defaulted on the coach.
Oh, okay. I think it was a good choice, but that is hilarious.
Oh, wait. I want to know who did the Doofus and Do-Right animation stuff, like drawing yeah. and stuff. I love that.
I love Doofus and Do-Right. Like, yeah. you know, I'm a child of the 70s, so Highlights for Children magazine in the doctor's office was, mm-hmm. you know, ingrained in my head. And so if people don't know, that's a magazine for kids that was often in doctor's offices. And there was a section in it called Goofus and Gallant. And Goofus and Gallant were basically a comic strip about manners. And it was like, you know, Goofus does things the wrong way. Gallant does things the right way. And it's very 50s. It's very 50s, 60s. It's real corny. And so... That was initially my idea. I said, I think that I want to do a training film in the style of that. The animation style, all of the animation, all the video animation in the ride was done by Soundalux, which was right across the street from Universal Florida. I forget which, it's like kind of right behind the site. There's a little teeny industrial park there with a bunch of post-production offices. I don't know if Soundalux is still there, but they're a local company in Orlando that does audio and video production and audio system design, video system design, audio engineering. And they had a very small animation team. And so they did all of that there. And they pitched me this idea of this very sort of googie style of things. And I just fell in love with it. That I am so proud of that safety film. It's one of, I think, the best things on the ride. And it's that example of how do you take the vibe of MIB that you know from the movies and the sense of humor from MIB that you know from the movies and extend it into, you know, lateral content and create something new out of it. It feels so much part of the world, but like this vintage thing that they've had forever, you know?
yeah.
And if you do know, if you look closely, and the vehicle that gets, when Doofus mistakenly takes a flash picture, there is a, that vehicle with Doofus has one passenger who is a little bit on the larger side with a beard. And that is a caricature of me in a Hawaiian shirt. So nice. That was snuck in. I didn't even realize it until like we were well into production and the artists go, you know, that's you. And I'm like, what? Oh, that's sweet.
it's incredible how you guys ended up going with the World's Fair aesthetic. Because it ties everything together so well
yeah.
with the like yeah. 50s, 60s retro MIB stuck in the past, and then the actual yeah. Flying ships, the spaceships from Flushing outside, and like mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the whole style, the Universe of You song and everything. So perfect.
Were you one of the people that that were mind blown when I mentioned that one of the spaceships was broken off the tower earlier this year? Did you go see that whole Twitter thread?
I did see the whole Twitter thread, but people kept pointing it out to me and I kept responding with, yeah, that's the way it's always been. Cause there was this weird, all of a sudden conspiracy that had been yeah. removed. And I'm like, no, that's the gag, guys. Seriously. That's the point. yeah. It's supposed to look like it was removed in the movie. Remember the movie? It happened.
yeah. I was blown away that people never saw that. It kind of made me happy that they never saw it, but I was also like, the things people don't notice.
No, I love that that's part of it. I also love the way it looks at night, the whole building with the like the dancing neon going back and forth.
That's beautiful. Great stuff. That was a relatively new tech at the time called Flow Neon. It is real neon, it's not LED, and neon has this funny thing where you can either turn on power on both ends at the same voltage, because you know they're basically tubes with electrical connections at the end. But somebody figured out if you modify the voltage from one side to the other, the light will whoop, shoot down it like a
it's
like
a so smooth.
Yeah, it's so it is an analog lighting effect that is actual neon gas moving. That's not wow. like an LED thing. It's really beautiful. Yeah,
that's really cool.
That and then there's the little sparkly strobes for a little star feel on the mm-hmm. wall, and then just the colors, all the lighting. Our lighting designer was a guy named Norm Schwab from a company called Light Switch, and he is a brilliant, genius lighting designer who can take all the credit for not only the exterior but the color story inside the building and the way the sets are lit. Everything that the lighting was one of those things that really ties a lot of things together, and he vibed with the design in a really profound way, and I think brought the building and the ride to life. I'm forever grateful because he's a genius lighting designer.
Was there going to be a restaurant? People always talk about the concept of a restaurant, and there's tons of YouTube videos where people are like, look, there's an M over the gift shop and there's an I on the restrooms and the B is missing. Yep. Where's the B? That must have been where the restaurant goes. So for the record,
it was. Yes. For the record, it was the architect who did the building outside of the building is Canner and Associates out of LA. They're very known for some very prominent LA architecture that was sort of Googie 60s revival. Like there's an In-N-Out Burger in Westwood that they did. If you look it up, it's this very cool Googie thing that was built in like the early 90s. So they leaned heavily into the time period. And yes, where the restrooms are now was going to be a restaurant. And it was sort of, if you took a letter B, it was the top of the B. And the idea was from a certain angle, standing on either the bridge in front of Back to the Future or further across the water, you would see the reflection of the building down below, and mm-hmm. the B would then complete. Do you know what I mean? It would be a mirror image of the B.
Okay.
Right. And so that was the subtle idea. And we looked at it, and it was A, it was really difficult to make it work well. B, the park decided they didn't need the food capacity. C, it didn't fit in the budget. So it was just it was cut pretty early on. But yes, there was a MIB commissary basically planned, but we never got past concept, so we never designed anything like interiors or food or drinks or anything. It was cut way before we finalized.
Well, you can do like the sequel and have it Burger King in there. remember they added Burger King into the immigration floor in that movie. MIB2 doesn't exist in my mind.
No, thank you. It's not very good. I love the third one.
Yeah, third one's great. The final bug, and before I ask the other question, Wikipedia thinks the final bug is Edgar for some reason.
No, not true.
Yeah, it is. Its name is Babs, right?
It's Babs. It's short for big ass bug. Yeah. I think Babs is actually, the name Babs is actually hidden on one of the info screens projected in Times Square, I think. Maybe. Maybe we didn't get away with that. But no, there are design cues like Edgar in terms of the color scheme and in terms of it being, you know, giant claws and eyes like a cockroach, but it is not supposed to be Edgar incarnate.
Bugs is a common thing. Like we got a bug, you know, downtown. Right. Like that's a common thing in the MIB world. So this it's quite big. He's much bigger. So big, in fact.
He swallows the vehicle, you know.
two vehicles.
not just Tommy Lee Jones, but two ride vehicles, yes.
I kind of faintly remember seeing something. It might have been your channel on YouTube. Is there a time capsule or something hidden inside of the big bug?
Yes, there is. Near the end of production, we took a bunch of photos from the team and from the project, and we took a couple of our construction badges and some swag and put it all into a little canister and shoved it into the wire framework that was being shotcreted over for the to become Babs. So it's hidden. If you're on the ride, it's right in the, like, you see like a soft palate underneath in the mouth that's right below the little tiny head that moves. It's basically in that general area. So when they dismantle the ride years from now, someone will find it, and it's probably all faded at this point, but we did do it.
Oh, so it's hidden behind concrete that's been sprayed on. So it's not accessible. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nope. Not accessible at all. Not as you chip away at something. Yeah.
That's awesome. Someday, No. I changed my statement. It's never going to be seen because the ride is never going to close.
Well, it's funny. Somebody asked me that a while back on the, you know, how does it feel to have it turn 20? And I said, well, first, it makes me feel old. Secondly, I look at the influence of a ride like Haunted Mansion on me is, it is impossible to understate. Right, like I have a tattoo about Haunted Mansion, for Christ's sakes. Like that going through that ride at 4 years old was a formative experience. And so when you look at when Haunted Mansion opened, it was what, 1967, right? So when I was a fan of that ride, which was in the late 70s, early 80s is when I first started getting an annual pass. So we're talking, you know, roughly 20 years into the Haunted Mansion's run is when I imprinted on it, even harder than when I did as a kid. And it already seemed like a classic to me then. So I look at Men in Black now and go, there are people that rode that ride as kids when we opened that are having the same enjoyment of it in the way that I enjoyed the Haunted Mansion, thinking it was a classic. And so it's really humbling to me. Like you don't go into these things expecting them to last forever or even that they'll be culturally relevant, right? And so the fact that it has stuck around and has all these fans is, I can't even tell you how gratifying that is for me and for the whole team. Like it really, to be seen in the echelon of 20-year-old attractions is a very short list of things. And we're very, very proud to be part of that tiny club.
When the MIB International was gearing up to go into theaters, they actually revamped and fixed a lot of the effects that hadn't been on in years. Some aliens that hadn't been working, a lot of lighting got upgraded.
Great.
Especially in the first two scenes of the actual like New York sets, and the big screen got replaced, all the ends projections got replaced, and it's great to see some love put into it. And all the Q videos have been remastered for HD. Like it's looking really good. I think the only thing that feels a little bit 2000-y still is the aliens for the other car screen. Like that one screen, may just be that they don't want to put the money up to re-render the footage to actually redo. So you're playing old. It kind of reminds me of the Cat in the Hat has that very 2000 CG look for that one little screen. And it's like, whoa. Bearing that one little moment, like the ride feels just as fresh and good and new as it always has. So like
I'm very flattered by that.
I think it's good for another 20 years, honestly.
I hope so. I hope they want to hold on to it. At the same token, you know, if they announce tomorrow that it's gone, I will be grateful that it ran the time it did, as long as it did with the fans that it did. So I hope to keep it around. And I hope, you know, I was hoping with Men in Black International, I thought, you know, I was hoping that there'd be renewed interest in the series. I didn't dislike that movie, but it didn't land, I think, the way it could have.
Right.
And I don't think it bears any need to upgrade the ride beyond what it is. But man, wouldn't it be great if, you know, they went through the whole thing with a fine tooth comb and upgraded all the tech and put in projection on mapping and all the stuff we've been talking about. Like, I would love to see that happening. It's probably unlikely because it really boils down to, you know, the license with Sony and how much longer Sony will let them pay for it. Frankly, they could say, nope, we're done. We want to be in the theme park industry ourselves or something. Who knows? You know, but Universal is holding on to it because it's a people eater. You know, it's a high capacity ride.
It's high satisfaction ride, you know.
People like it over and over again. It rates really high in every exit poll. And on top of that, I think one of the biggest reasons is it appeals to everybody, right? It's not a thrill ride. It's not just a kid's ride. It's not just a family ride. It's all of those things.
And no offense, but it's not a screen ride.
Right.
They kind of need it for numbers. It's
physical stuff. Right.
So, but okay. I think that's going to wrap up our discussion. Thank you so much for being here. Dave Cobb, you can find him on YouTube and on the Twitter. Where else are you located?
YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, all as Dave Cobb.
Yeah, so it's super easy to find you. Type in MIB if you get some other Dave Cobb, though.
Yeah, there's a famous music producing Dave Cobb, Grammy award winning Dave Cobb that I get mistweeted at all the time. But
did you not get a Grammy for The Universe in You? You wrote the lyrics. Come on.
No. And it's funny. I've actually reached out to him a couple of times and we've had a nice laugh on DMs on Twitter. because he's really, really well known. Like he produced the soundtrack to Star Is Born with Lady Gaga. Like he's huge.
Oh wow, yeah.
And yeah, and so we've had a good laugh about it. And we said, well, eventually when this all ends, let's have coffee in LA and break the internet someday.
Dave Cobb's a picture of us
and, yeah, Cobception.
Have a Cobb salad. Okay, I'm sorry. I walked myself out.
I resisted that one.
No.
It was a Los Angeles thing. I'm sorry. I couldn't help but tie it all together. Oh.
I like a good dad joke. I'm much appreciated.
Even I resisted that bad joke.
I know, Ian. This is supposed to be your job. Wait, I have a thing. There we go.
And on that note.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Dave. It was awesome talking to you, man.
All right. We'll talk later.
Promises.